speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you for being in our audience today. The American people are fiercely competitive, a fact which some liberal educators and modernistic theologians have severely criticized. But competition can be either good or bad, depending on the direction it takes. Our American competitive free enterprise system of economics has provided more goods and services for more people than any other economic system in the world. Technologically, the United States has surpassed any other nation in the history of the world. To a great extent, the American success story is directly related to competition. Competition in every field, medicine, business, manufacturing, education, has contributed tremendously to our economic and professional well-being. On the other hand, we can become so competitive, so intent on winning, that we overlook compassion, honesty, justice, and goodness. Some businessmen and professional people are so determined to win that they trample on thousands of people, ignore legitimate needs of our citizens, rape the earth's natural resources, and contaminate the atmosphere. For them, winning is not just the best thing in life, it is the only thing. Michael Milken, the junk bond king, is one example of this almost total disregard for the welfare of others. Ivan Vosky is another example. These men apparently thought that winning was so important that they were willing to engage in illegal and immoral activities. They both made and retained fortunes from their greed. Winning, whether in business, in sports, or in love, is very important, but it is not all there is in life. When we hear certain sports figures talk about their team exploits, it is easy to get the impression that nothing matters beyond winning. It is not unusual to hear a coach or a player or a business tycoon say, "We are going to win whatever it takes." People with that attitude are likely to engage in underhanded, illegal, and unscrupulous behavior. In fact, our newspapers and magazines are full of the deeds of men and women who have tried to win, and in many cases did win, regardless of the cost. As valid and significant as competition is in many phases of life, should we not use the Bible as our guide in planning our winning strategies? Should not Christians put God and family and country before winning? I'm not saying or even implying that Christians cannot win or should not win. But winning a ball game or a business contract is not so important as living by principles of righteousness. But can we win by observing Christian principles which are outlined in the Bible? Would it surprise you to learn that there are many who call themselves Christians who think you are bound to lose if you follow the teachings of Jesus Christ and of the apostles? Ted Turner called Christians losers. Tragically, there are many sports figures, including some nationally known coaches, who would do almost anything to win. Some college and university teams violate NCAA regulations by improper recruiting of athletes, or by paying them on the side for their performance, or by other unsportsmanlike and immoral means. I have seen coaches throw chairs on the gym floor when they did not like what the referees were doing. Responsible university presidents should fire such coaches immediately or sooner. College and high school sports touch the lives of countless thousands of Americans, both young and old. But they do not have the effect on so many young people as do our business and professional leaders. All of us have known business and professional people who have used every conceivable means to get to the top of the heap. They have lied, stolen, cheated, and even killed to achieve their goals. There is no point in our denying the truth of these immoral practices. John D. Rockefeller, a staunch evolutionist, did not believe that Christian ethics should govern business development. He believed in using whatever means were necessary to achieve his goals. He used the law and unscrupulous lawyers to expand his business interests, regardless of the countless thousands of people who were hurt in the process. There is no way of estimating the number of people who were hurt by the evil plots and plans of John D. Rockefeller and his associates. Andrew Carnegie belonged in the same category. In modern times, he is best known for his generosity in endowing libraries throughout the United States. But he was a bitter enemy of Christianity, probably because its moral values ran contrary to his evolutionary views. His faith in the survival of the fittest guided him in his dealings with his fellow men. He might have been mean and ruthless, even if he had never heard of the Darwinian theory of evolution. But evolution unquestionably had a direct bearing on his crooked dealings. Probably no businessman or politician embodies the win-at-any-cost philosophy better than Joseph Kennedy Sr., the father of John, Bobby, and Teddy Kennedy. The unconscionable behavior of the Kennedy clan, including John Fitzgerald Kennedy, is chronicled in a book, A Question of Character, A Life of John F. Kennedy by Thomas C. Reeves. The book by Reeves is not yellow journalism, but a serious historical examination of the Kennedy dynasty. The book has the endorsement of Jonathan Yardley of the Washington Post, who wrote, "This is the best biography I read this year." It also has the endorsement of the Los Angeles Times and of other reputable people and organizations. According to Yardley, the book is a revisionist view of John F. Kennedy, from which his reputation is unlikely ever fully to recover. The Los Angeles Times says, "The John Kennedy who emerges from these pages was not a man of good moral character. He was not reared to be good, but to win." Thomas Reeves says that Joe Kennedy wanted to be a millionaire by the age of 35. When he reached that age, he was a millionaire many times over. Reeves thinks Joe was involved in illegal liquor trade during Prohibition. One mobster reported that Joe was involved in a hijacked shipment of whiskey from Ireland to Boston. Page 27. Reeves commented on Kennedy's penchant for lechery and then added, "In politics, they would do what it took to win." Page 31. The Kennedys were completely devoted to getting whatever they wanted, no matter who was hurt in the process. In their religious activities, they may have talked about integrity, humility, and love, but their religious life had little or nothing to do with their daily lives. They were not going to allow anything or anyone to keep them from achieving their goals. The Founding Father thus commanded. Page 33. Thomas Reeves quotes from Richard J. Whaling's carefully researched biography of Joseph Kennedy, the Founding Father, as follows. "Joseph Kennedy was an unscrupulous manipulator, shamelessly willing to plot and spend in order to propel his son into the White House. He succeeded in instilling in his children the same beliefs and the same drive which had made him a name to be feared. He pushed his children to fulfill the design he believed had been ordained." Page 6. There is a question which seems especially pertinent to me, since we spend weeks on television and in the print media eulogizing Kennedy every anniversary of his assassination. The question is, why do the media exalt John F. Kennedy? They cannot be ignorant of the illegal and immoral deals he arranged to get into the White House. They have to know about the dozens and dozens of young women he brought into the residence. They know he was guided and ruled by his infamous father. They treat him as if he were some kind of God, and his years in the White House as if they really did constitute Camelot. The influence of the Kennedy clan has been decidedly detrimental, morally, spiritually, politically, financially, and in many other ways. Politics and politicians have long been considered inherently rotten, although that need not be the case. The word politics comes from the Greek politeis, which means the science of good government. But in too many cases, politics deteriorates into using one's position to enrich his own personal financial condition and that of his friends. The very mention of scoundrels like Lester Maddox of Georgia, Huey P. Long of Louisiana, Mayor Richard Daley of Chicago, and Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts is enough to turn one's stomach on political matters. How does one explain the re-election of Ted Kennedy, or Jerry Studs, or Bob Packwood? George Grant's 1991 book, The Quick and the Dead, tells the story of the development of RU486, the French abortion pill. The developer of the pill was Dr. Etienne A. Neil Bloom, a highly respected French physician. Dr. Bloom engaged in an intense campaign to have his baby-killing pill approved by the government and accepted by the populace. He angrily criticized religious fundamentalists and right-wing Protestants and Roman Catholics. Please listen to Dr. Bloom's pragmatic and unchristian philosophy. "I really don't see a division between politics, industry, and medicine. Each mechanism helps to contribute to the overall goal. I just do whatever it takes to win." Page 105. Were you listening to that last statement by Dr. Bloom? "I just do whatever it takes to win." That was also the philosophy of Hitler, of Stalin, of Idi Amin, of Pol Pot, and of other ruthless killers. In the long run, Dr. Bloom will probably succeed in killing more human beings than all of these monsters combined. He just does whatever it takes to win. Such an attitude on the part of politicians keeps millions of Americans from going to the polls. Let me return briefly to Thomas C. Reeves' book, A Question of Character, A Life of John F. Kennedy. If you have ever had any doubt as to whether or not the Kennedys bought the presidency, that they intended to win whatever the cost, please listen carefully. In 1966, Richard Cardinal Cushing of Boston said to Hubert Humphrey, "I'll tell you who elected Jack Kennedy. It was his father, Joe, and me, right here in this room." The Cardinal explained that he and Joe Kennedy determined which Protestant preachers would be given money for their support of Kennedy. Cardinal Cushing smiled and said to Humphrey, "It's good for the church, it's good for the preacher, and it's good for the candidate." Page 165. I guess I'm having some problems figuring out how it is good for the Lord to have such an immoral man in the White House. Here is a revelation which ought to anger every American citizen. The FBI learned through wiretaps that the Mafia made large contributions to the Kennedy campaign in West Virginia. Those donations were distributed by Frank Sinatra. The money was used to buy key officials. One Mafia boss distributed thousands and thousands of dollars to local sheriffs so that they could get out the vote for Kennedy. Page 166. My friends, there are literally hundreds of other quotations from Thomas Reeves' book which I could use to show that the Kennedys were determined to win whatever the cost. But these should be sufficient to awaken us to what often occurs on the political scene in the United States and in the various states of our Union. Obviously, we cannot go back and undo what the Kennedys and other crooked politicians have done. But can we not learn from their examples not to place such men and women in high positions? Should we not make a practice of voting for men and women who are committed to right principles? Any time we put a man in office who lies, deceives, and misleads us, we are helping to sound the death knell to our democratic system of government. Searching for and electing honest men and women to public office have never been easy. But we have no other choice if we want to preserve our freedom, our moral values, and our sanity. I plead with you not to be deceived by empty promises of politicians. But surely churches would never be guilty of using pragmatic means for furthering their religious agendas. Or would they? Many of us, perhaps most of us, have come to expect sports, business, and politics to be dirty, although there is no reason they ought to be that way. But those who claim to be Christians must never fall in with the fleeting fashions of this world, the literal meaning of Romans 12:2. The Scriptures make it very plain that God expects all of us, regardless of our professions, occupations, or avocations, to be honest, upright, and truthful. Please listen to these inspired statements. Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide for honest things in the sight of all men. Romans 12:17. Paul issued similar admonitions to the Corinthians, providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. 2 Corinthians 8:21. Paul also commanded the Ephesians, "Let him who stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands that thing which is good, that he may have to give to him who needs." Ephesians 4:28. Scriptures like these can be multiplied by the hundreds, but these ought to be sufficient to show what our Heavenly Father expects of all men. He wants us to be honest, fair, and gracious. These passages from Paul's writings are clear and powerful messages from God's holy book. Do you think some churches will do whatever it takes to win, regardless of what these scriptures teach? Would church leaders ever have the attitudes of some business people, sports figures, and politicians, that we are going to win regardless of the cost? If you believe that cannot happen, you are not keeping up with what is taking place among various religious groups in the United States. Let me give you some illustrations of what I have in mind. There are cases where elders and other church leaders are so concerned about increasing numbers or keeping those who attend that they demand that the preacher soft-pedal the gospel message. They generally do not come right out and say the preacher ought to be a little less demanding in his sermons. They gently remind him how easy it is for some people to be offended and suggest he be very careful in his presentations. Of course, there are church leaders who tell the preacher if he is going to discuss marriage, divorce, and remarriage, he ought to begin to look for work elsewhere. Do you think I'm exaggerating? I assure you I'm not. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage are not the only topics which some elders and members find intolerable and offensive. If there are drinkers, adulterers, or homosexuals in the congregation, we may be warned to go easy on these topics also. After all, we would not want to damage anyone's self-esteem or self-worth, would we? I once worked in a school setting where one woman objected to my speaking out against the women's liberation movement, abortion, and other social issues. When I went to preach in a meeting where she was supposed to be attending worship services, she asked the local preacher, "What social issues will he be discussing during this meeting?" Is it any wonder she has lost her son to agnosticism and unbelief? Some preachers are so determined to keep their positions, they are willing to sell their souls for a mess of pottage. The Apostle Peter mentioned Balaam, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. 2 Peter 2:15. Churches in our day certainly do not need any more Balaams. We already have an abundant supply. We need some Elijahs, Micaiahs, Jeremiahs, and Amoses. These great Old Testament prophets were not for sale to the highest bidder. They preached the truth even when their lives were in danger. My friends, it does not make any difference about one's occupation or profession. One cannot use unchristian and illegal means to get what he wants. We must not have the attitude, We will do whatever it takes to win. I want to win, but by following the one who has already won the ultimate victory, the Lord Jesus Christ. Thank you for listening, and may God richly bless you.